This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics, and the reaction to the Bondi Beach massacre is top of mind. And now, politicians from all levels are saying the right things, and that is a step in the right direction because even that was glaringly absent here in Canada beforehand. But the question is, will the talk lead to any action? There's still a lot of finger pointing. The police blame the politicians, saying they don't back them up. Part of the reason they don't charge people who are clearly violating the law in those very aggressive and sometimes violent so-called anti-Israel, anti-Jewish protests. And then politicians at the municipal and provincial levels blame Ottawa, saying that the laws we have are not enforceable, while Ottawa says, hey, we have a better law in our back pocket. It's just not enforced yet. So, will that lead to any action? Also, as Jeremy mentioned, Queen's Park is on an extended break. Another extended break. Now, last week I did the math, and MPPs in the last year are in their seats for just 19 weeks out of 52, making being an MPP a very well-paying part-time job. And remember, they voted themselves a big increase, what was it, a year ago or so? So, we will see what our recovering politicians think of that. And what about Doug Ford's plan to remake Niagara Falls as Vegas of the North?
And now, the recovering politicians panel.
And now I'd like to welcome George Smitherman, former Deputy Premier and Health Minister of Ontario, Sherry DeNovo, former Member of Provincial Parliament of Ontario, and Lisa Raitt, former Deputy Leader and Cabinet Minister of the Conservative Party of Canada. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Libby.
Well, so I am wondering, there's The only hopeful thing to come out of this is that some people think maybe it will mark a turning point, because from what we can see here at home and abroad, politicians that the Jewish community would consider as abetting and appeasing the anti-Semitism seem to be more on side. Lisa, do you think this might be a turning point?
I hope so. And this is the caution to elected officials on this one. You may have wanted to turn a blind eye and not really notice what was happening in the actual protests in and around the GTA, but you can't do it anymore, because the word from Australia is that people are shocked, but they're not surprised. And now we cannot claim either. We can't complain. We can't say that we were shocked or that we were surprised, because unfortunately we have seen this tragedy and this devastation happen in our own time, in our own eyes. And that means elected officials have a great onus upon them, I think, to act and act accordingly and act quickly.
Yeah, well, and some of it, you know, I have to say, when you see people like Olivia Chow, who I think is beyond appeasing this, has been abetting it. When you see her making her pious remarks, it is a little frankly, nauseating. But she is the mayor, and maybe that will go some distance to changing things. Sherry?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I think there's a lot of conflation, which, of course, sadly only happens with the Jewish community, between being Jewish and whatever a government is doing at that time. I mean, you know, as a good friend just said to me, you know, that a 10-year-old on Bondi Beach is not in the Israeli cabinet. A child attending school in Toronto, Jewish school in Toronto, is not in the Israeli cabinet. I mean, this is, you know, if you post about a latke recipe on social media, it's not a cause for, you know, talking about Gaza. You know, I mean, and this is where I think we've done it best is actually within the faith communities, because I've been part of those sort of rings of love and support and light around both mosques and synagogues done by all the people of the book in the city. So when we're at our best, particularly at this time of year, that's what we should be doing as good allies, is immediately reaching out and immediately making sure that our neighbors are safe. So, you know, this is not just about the politicians and what they do or they don't do. This is about us. And I think we all have a responsibility to do that.
Well, yes, but also in the faith community, for instance, United Church, BDS movement, boycott, divest, conflates. I mean, the whole issue is that I think a lot of especially Islamic radicals have been very successful in kind of rebranding anti-Semitism. We call it anti-Israel. If it's anti-Israel, it's been okay, George. And this is what it leads to, because being anti-Israel means, you know, assaulting Jews at Bathurst and Shepherd.
I think, you know, first and foremost, the targeting of any community is, you know, it's just so heart-wrenching to have witnessed that. And as a gay person, I haven't really been that subjected to it, but there were times in our community when people would come, you know, downtown and just look for gay people to target them, etc. And so I think first and foremost, it's for governmental officials here to look for all ways they can to ensure that the Jewish community where it congregates is not a target. And I do think, to your question earlier, that this will enhance all scrutiny from all quarters on the kind of activities that are occurring in protests. And I think, you know, we have to continue. Like, for me, it's an easy thing to say. Like, I love the Jewish community. I have many Jewish friends, even if I'm not a supporter of the Netanyahu government. So, you know, I do hope to your question at the beginning that some good can come of it in terms of more scrutiny of acts which are anti-Semitic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a supporter of the Netanyahu government either. As a matter of fact, I'm a critic of it. But these things get conflated. And I have to say, George, since you mentioned the gay community, one of the most inexplicable aspects of this are gay groups supporting Hamas. When, you know, if you're gay in Gaza, you're putting your life at risk. And the only gay positive place in the entire Middle East is Israel. But
I take your point, but like, don't treat the gay community like some monolithic community, because I had someone recently ask me at a Christmas dinner. They said, why is everybody? I said, you know, that's the mistake to make. The gay community is no monolith. And I think that within the broader gay community, there are a lot of friends of Jewish people, Israel, and a lot of people that celebrate Tel Aviv, kind of on the point that you were making. But of course, in a community that big and diverse, there are going to be divergent voices. But
absolutely, no, I didn't mean to suggest that the gay community is a monolith. As a matter of fact, no community is a monolith.
Right.
And it's a problem when they are treated as such, whichever community it is. But let's talk a little bit about the community of MPPs, particularly the progressive conservative ones at Queen's Park. I mean, this is vacation on vacation, and they say it's not a vacation. But Lisa, I mean, I'm assuming that they're taking yet another very, very long break because they can.
It's extraordinary, I have to say. So federally, we have a calendar that is set down by law, and that's what you have to abide by. And it's a lot of more days sitting than they do in the Ontario legislature or in other legislatures, actually, in the country. What I, you know, it's funny, Libby, I used to think about this from only through the eyes of a cabinet minister, because that's what I was. And I would say, oh, of course, they have a lot of work to do. And they're probably working just as hard in getting it all done. And then I think about MPPs, and I think about opposition MPPs. And I think, if you're not going to the legislature, how are you filling your day? How are you getting in front of the government to get your points across? How are you affecting change in your community? And I think that's the part of it. It's not great for the opposition at all to not have sitting days. It's great for the government. It's great for cabinet. I think sitting MPPs, if they're not in either of those two things, they probably are looked at in their community like, what are you up to?
Well, yeah, maybe they need some counseling if they don't have enough to do, though. I guess you can always go to there is no shortage of meetings and events in each small community. But it really looks bad on them, George, and the only reasonable explanation, aside from because they can, is to dodge scandals.
I think that's right. I do, though. I really think I take exception always to, they say, oh, well, the legislature's not sitting, so they're all on holidays. I think any of us could attest to the fact that that just means more focus on the community, more times for constituent meetings. Those are all a really valuable part of the job. So I really don't think we should convey that everybody is on holidays when they're not at the legislature. But I know I can't reverse that one. That's deeply ensconced. But I would say this, that the government sat for as few days as it could and used every aggressive tool at its fingertips to jam all of its legislation through. And I think it's exactly right, is that right now, sitting days and especially question period are their vulnerability. So they'll do anything that they can to limit the number of days that they are available for the opposition to scrutinize their, you know, current inflamed scandal.
Sherry, so Lisa has said she didn't think Dave Piccini would be in place in January. And it looks like he will be, if only because nothing is happening. You know, do you think that they can get away with this? Do you think the public will forget about brewing scandals like the skills development thing? And also, you know, I agree that there can be plenty of work outside the legislature, but to a lot of people, it does look like, what are we paying these people for?
Yeah, it looks bad, and I think it is bad. And I concur with what George said, though. I mean, the hardest I worked was in the constituency, not at Queen's Park. And politicians work really hard. I mean, no matter it's the sitting days. So I want to correct that. But I mean, yeah, I mean, this is a way of you know, getting away from the questioning that they should be subjected to. And we still haven't heard from the RCMP about the Greenbelt. So, I mean, these scandals go back quite a ways now. And you know, they're not allowing committees to sit. They're not allowing the public in to scrutinize legislation. So this is part of a trend in this government. And all I can say is part of the problem is majority government, quite frankly. I mean, I think we need to look, and every party does this until they have a majority government, look at the way we elect people. Because the first past the post system, when you've got a majority government, you do what you can get away with anything. I mean, that's a simple reality. And I think the public needs to be better served than that. Let's have some scrutiny on the political system, as well as this particular government, who 19 weeks is not enough.
Yeah, it's not enough. But Lisa, so Doug Ford is in a really good position. He is enjoying a very large popularity. So what do you think is driving that with these scandals in the background? I think people will relate to the skills development thing. It does seem to be beyond the pale. We've got the green belt, which seems to be long forgotten. Do you think that it was his emergence as Captain Canada that's helping him? I mean, I'm sure politicians are looking at him and saying, you know, I'll have what he's having.
I would say that it's very clear that he is, whatever he's doing, it's successful. But the second thing that I would say is, you know, the scandals that you talked about really aren't on top of mind for the regular Ontario voter. They're thinking about how much their gas costs, how much their food is, and they're thinking about affordable housing for themselves and for their kids and their family. So it's really hard to punch through. And I guess that's where, back to the legislature, that's where the legislature comes in handy, because the opposition would find their time there to hammer away on the government and keep bringing up these issues. And there's no place for them to shout into a vacuum, essentially. There's no news coverage going to be coming, because it's going to be hard for Mayor Stiles, for example, just to call a press conference and have people show up on a continuous basis to talk about the same thing if there's nothing new.
But what is Ford's secret sauce, in your opinion?
Yeah, you're right. I think, thank you for that. You put your finger on it, which is the fact that he came out so strongly against something that Ontarians really feel strongly about as well, and that is Donald Trump and the United States and his administration. And that's exactly what ends up happening. You're thinking about those things, and you're not thinking about what may have happened within the government amongst some other people and money and skills and stuff like that. So I think it's effective. I don't know whether or not, I hesitate to say that it's an act. I don't think it's an act. I think the premier really does believe in what he's talking about when it comes to Donald Trump and the administration. I would say it's more or less a happy circumstance for him in terms of diversion, as opposed to some kind of policy or some kind of strategy to get away from scandal.
George, what do you think the premier's secret sauce is, and what can the leaderless Liberals learn from it?
I think that the secret sauce is a combination of the contrast with Trump and relative likability. And I think what the Liberals and the opposition could do to change that is to lay a fit on a board that you don't leave, a moniker, or like actually really start to mark them up, because absent of some effort to mark him up, as long as he's got these conditions, especially Trump, it's going to be very, very difficult. I do think beyond Trump, if and when that occurs or how that occurs, that there is a lot of vulnerability for this government, I think particularly around healthcare challenges. But there's no oxygen for anything really other than Trump at the moment. And Ford is going to successfully ride that for as long as he can.
Sherry, you know, I think that there's also possibly a bit of sexism at play, where people, I'm hearing, you know, Merritt Stiles, I think she's lately been perceived as more shrill or something like that. And I think that's probably got a bit of sexism about it. But I also think people love, like, the Ford-isms, my favorite being, you know, the cheese fell off the cracker. I love that. But so what do you think the NDP could learn from his secret sauce?
Well, First of all, shout out to the back room of the Conservative Party, because we tend to underestimate the value of all of those folks that aren't in front of the camera, and they're very valuable, and clearly they're doing an incredible job. And the way even they have positioned Ford as being kind of Uncle Doug and Mr. Canada, all of that has played in his favor, and he's not doing it alone, and I think he'd be the first to admit he's not. So the back room of the Liberal and NDP right now, well, certainly going into the last election showed that it wasn't up to much, and so that's where the problem lies, I think, because you know leaders are the front face of the organization and of course put their stamp on it, but I mean they need good staff. So Just, I guess, since everybody's on a break right now from Queen's Park, just a shout out to all the staff there who do incredible work, all of them. But some of them, you know, just really, you know, have their finger on the zeitgeist a little bit more than most. And I think you got to give it to the conservative backroom on the provincial level for sure.
Speaking of staff and staff parties, so getting back to the floor crossing, and I've heard some people describe it that now that the Carney government is within one seat of a majority, you know, we've had floor crossings before, but they don't necessarily amount to much. There can be, you know, a new cabinet minister like with Belinda Stronach, but I've seen this one characterized that it, if there is one more, and we're getting hints that there could be, this would have been the most effective one in terms of really changing the nature of what we voted for in the last election, Lisa.
Yeah, you know, I keep thinking that for me, I will pay attention when somebody who crosses the floor, who knows Pierre well, who's been with him for a long time, and just has lost faith in the party. Both Don Tremont and Michael Ma were two, I think, particular situations you can explain. But it doesn't look good, Libby. It doesn't look good to be losing people like this. And it doesn't look good on the leader in terms of him saying, I think, to another reporter, I don't know whether or not it's even over. So I think there's going to be a lot of calls to all the caucus members over the winter to take their temperature and see how they're doing. And that's what he should be doing.
Yeah, that's him. But on the other side of it, I mean, if there ends up being another one and it gives Mark Carney a majority, how significant would you see that as being?
I think that's incredibly significant. And I think that's where Pierre could start seeing some more murmurings coming out of the party than he is right now. Right now, he's not going to have any problem at all with respect to his review in January.
Yeah, George, you know, you've got to say that in terms of that end of things, the Liberals in Ottawa seem to be handling everything despite the lack of progress on the most important files, which are, of course, trade and tariffs.
Well, I think that they're managing a broad agenda, and the polling, you might say the party numbers have changed, but so long as the numbers are Carney, you know, 2-1 over Poilievre in terms of who do you think is best suited to manage Canada at this time or however they pose it, that's a really very difficult thing to come past. The question I have is, do the Liberals already know who's coming or who's warm? And are they telling them to wait until after Pierre gets his vote and is ensconced as the leader? That's, you know, that's how, in a certain sense, I would say cocky some of the discussion is around this. I think to your point is, will the next one be instrumental, kind of like a kingmaker, I suppose? Maybe they'll come as a pair. I mean, I think that there are more out there, and I predicted that first on this state, on this radio show, like quite a while ago. I think almost regardless of the outcome of the vote for Pierre in January, I think that people are going to continue to look, a few of them, for opportunities across the aisle.
And Sherry, there's also a leaderless federal NDP. We haven't been hearing much about them. Do you see anyone in that mix who could take the NDP out of the wilderness?
Well, I think Avi Lewis is clearly the front runner there these days, so we will see. But I mean, the problem is that's not going to happen till March. So, you know, that's a lot of time in politics to be leaderless and to be sinking in the polls. So a real problem in terms of the Liberals, though, for sure somebody's going to cross the aisle. And I think George is right on the money. I mean, the strategy, the good strategic play here is wait till Poilievre goes back. I mean, with polling like his, you want him in leadership for the Conservative Party, and, you know, and then bring the person on before the next budget vote. I mean, because as Poilievre said himself, you know, the Liberal Party now is fake conservatives or something to that effect. I mean, he basically just paved the laneway for somebody to walk across the aisle with that. I don't know. I mean, I think if I were a conservative, I would want new leadership personally at this point rather than fall into the Liberal clear plan for getting another member and keeping the same badly polling leader of the opposition.
Well, they have a history of getting rid of their leaders after one go around has not served them well. We're almost out of time. So I'm going to ask George, is there anyone emerging as a possible leader for the provincial Liberals?
I mean, not really. I think that Lee Fairclough from Etobicoke Lakeshore is getting more attention than maybe a few weeks ago. Mike Crawley, a former party president that I mentioned with some success in business, is out there, but it's a pretty quiet and dull field for now. Leaving a debate, I think, as to whether there should be a leadership race sooner or actually relatively later. It's a challenging time for the provincial Liberals in that sense.
Okay, well, obviously that's got to be one factor in the ascendancy of the Conservatives here in Ontario, and of the Liberals in Ottawa, is a lack of strong leadership on the opposition side. I'm looking at the clock. It's time to wrap things up. We are going to have one more panel before Christmas, where I hope we have more positive things to talk about. In the meantime, thank you so much, George Smitherman, Sherry DeNovo, and Lisa Raitt. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, Libby.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you all, and Happy Hanukkah. We're taking a break. When we come back, well, four terror plots were foiled. So the Bondi Beach massacre, which the authorities say is inspired by ISIS, an ISIS flag was found. No question that this was an expression of radical jihadi Islamic ideology. But there's apparently more where that came from. And we'll talk about that when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the Bondi Beach massacre is not an isolated incident. There is clear evidence it was another example of radical Islamic terror. And it looks like ISIS is in an active period in Australia. Police found an ISIS flag in one of the assailants' cars. And it turns out that both father and son were recently in an area of the Philippines where ISIS is active. In the U.S., federal authorities foiled a plot to bomb multiple sites of two U.S. companies on New Year's Eve in Southern California. And they arrested members of an extremist group as those four suspects were rehearsing the plot. So what is behind it? And by the way, here in Canada, the authorities, CSIS, says that there's no evidence of a credible threat, a credible and imminent threat. But they're saying that it's possible that a small group or a lone actor could do something mobilizing to violence with little or no intelligence forewarning. So is that just an example of them covering their behinds, or are we in the middle of some kind of resurgence of ISIS? So let us go to Phil Gursky, who is the president of Borealis Threat and Risk, and he is a former senior strategic terrorism analyst at CSIS, and also Ward Elcock, who is a former CSIS director. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, pleasure.
Okay, let's begin with Phil. So do you see, I mean, we've had conversations before, and even when others think that maybe ISIS has gone aground, you say, no, they haven't. What's your read on the situation now?
Well, that's exactly it, Libby. And I push back against this notion that there's been a resurgence of ISIS, because they never de-surged in the first place, if I can use that word. Certainly the so-called caliphate was dismantled in 2019, but there's daily attacks in Iraq and Syria and Kurdistan by ISIS. Two U.S. soldiers were just killed last week by ISIS. They've got provinces across the world. We've had ISIS-inspired plots here in Canada, Libby. We had one in Markham last year. We had that Pakistani student on a student visa wanted to travel from Toronto to New York to carry out attack against Jewish targets. So, no, ISIS is still by far the single greatest lethal terrorist group in the world. And so what happened in Australia does not surprise me at all. The Philippines angle is really interesting. We may want to talk about that later. But the bottom line is, no, ISIS never went away, and they're not going to go away anytime soon.
Ward, what's your take on that?
Oh, I'd agree entirely with Phil. I never thought ISIS had gone away. It clearly hasn't. We haven't had that many attacks in the West over the last while, but that doesn't mean that ISIS has disappeared and is no longer a threat. I'm sure the service is still fully preoccupied by potential threat from organizations like ISIS.
Well, yes, and in my introduction, I failed to mention that attack in Syria that President Trump was up in arms about. He's saying there will be a heavy price to pay. What do you think that will look like, Phil?
Well, probably airstrikes. The problem is that, and I pointed this out in a book many years ago, Libby, you don't win the so-called war on terrorism, which is a terrible term, by the way, by military means alone. You have to infiltrate groups. You have to eliminate people. You have to monitor them. You have to investigate them. But if you think that bombing ISIS is going to destroy ISIS, well, we tried that for 5 years in the 2010s, and it didn't work. I'm not saying there isn't a role for military. There certainly is. But there's so many groups, whether it's in Nigeria or Somalia or Pakistan. Like, we were in Afghanistan for 20 years. And what happened to the Taliban? Well, they took over power again in 2021. So this notion that we can simply airstrike our way to victory against terrorist groups is simply a myth. Again, it does play a role, but it is not the sort of the final blow and after which terrorist groups decide to give up their cause.
How much do we know about how the Bondi Beach attackers were, quote, radicalized?
We don't know a lot. We certainly know that the ASIO, which is the Australian equivalent of CSIS, a great organization with which I worked very closely over the years. I'm sure Ward would agree we had a great relationship with ASIO. It's part of the Five Eyes. They had investigated the Sun as far back as 2019. Now, the problem is that people say, well, ASIO was asleep at the switch. No. They did their due diligence. They investigated this young man. And at the time, they assessed he did not pose an imminent threat. Now, the problem when you work at CSIS or ASIO or the FBI or MI5, you got more cases than you got people. And you're making very difficult decisions on the fly about whether or not to continue investigations, because it's resource intensive and it's time intensive. So what happened between 2019 and 2025? Don't know. The fact the father's involved is fascinating to me. We had that case in Markham, you remember, Libby?
Yeah.
The father's son in Markham that wanted to go and attack Jewish targets in Toronto. Not the first time we've seen father and son. We've got the Cotter family in Canada. The whole Rootin-Tootin family was Al-Qaeda family in the 1990s. No, we have to learn a lot more about the radicalization process, but clearly the son was on the radar at one point. And whatever happened in the last 6 or 7 years, that'll be the interesting question going forward.
Well, I mean, to me, there's no question that when it comes to transmitting prejudices and hatreds, the family unit can be very effective. And I'm sure that, I mean, I would bet that the son here was raised with those hatreds from the time that he was very small, and that's how it happens, unfortunately. You know, everywhere is that. You know, we seem to be hearing a lot more about ISIS just in the last few weeks, Phil.
Yeah. The Poles just thwarted an attack by what looks like to be a convert.
Yes.
ISIS inspired. The Germans just foiled another attack on a Christmas market. The attack in Syria, probably ISIS, but not necessarily. The soldier was apparently on the verge of being fired for his extremist views. Could have been ISIS, could have been Al-Qaeda, could have been another group. But yeah, the New Year's Eve attack last year, and almost a year ago now, Libby, in New Orleans, was an ISIS-inspired attack as well. Again, I go back to my earlier comment, and Ward and I are in complete agreement. ISIS is the number one threat. It has been for the better part of a decade and a half, and it's not going away. And I wish people would stop pretending that somehow we can move on from this threat to look at other threats. We have to look at all threats simultaneously with limited resources.
Yeah, I mean, the Australians cited limited resources as one reason why this particular attack wasn't thwarted, Ward.
Pardon? You're thinking of the attack in Australia?
Yes, sorry.
Well, it could be limited resources, but the reality is, too, that as Phil said earlier, intelligence services never have all the resources they need to watch everybody all the time, despite the fact that some people believe that's what intelligence agencies do. The reality is you do triage, and so you target what are the most serious threats, and they had made a presumably an assessment that this individual was not a threat, had not seen anything that caused them to look back at him, and somewhere along the line he went off the rails.
The other thing,
and it's very hard when you're dealing with a lone wolf kind of attack, and this is really more of a lone wolf kind of attack, even if there are two of them. It's very hard to spot a lone wolf attack.
One of the things that really struck me in Australia, which has very strict gun laws, was that the father was able to legally purchase guns, even though he had the same address as the son who had been under investigation. Is that the kind of loophole we might have here, Phil?
Hard to say. I'm certainly not a gun expert, Libby, by any stretch of the imagination. My understanding is the father is a member of a hunting club. I guess that's not illegal in Australia. I don't know what kind of vetting procedures they have in that country or that kind of thing. The other thing, Libby, as I mentioned earlier, is the Philippines angle. It looks like they were in the Philippines a few weeks before the attack. In the southern Philippines, which is an area which has been rife with Islamist extremism, a group called the Abu Sayyaf group has been around for a very long time. People have dismissed them as sort of yesterday's threat. They're not, you know, they don't pose the threat they once did. I push back against that. I'd be curious of exactly what they learned in the Philippines. They probably didn't get their weapons from the Philippines. They appear to have got some kind of training, according to ASIO. But the whole gun thing, we know that Australia is relatively, mass attacks are relatively rare with firearms in Australia, unlike the United States, where they happen every 5 minutes, it seems.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're going to revisit their laws and revisit who gets a gun and why. And the fact that the father got one with the son on a list. But as Ward said, you know, once you've been investigated and you've determined there's no immediate threat, you don't kind of remain on the radar. And I'm not sure what kind of records you would go moving forward to say, well, because we investigated the son, the father wouldn't have access to a gun license if he's perfectly qualified for getting one.
Huh. Interesting. Ward, is there something that authorities here in Canada should be learning from this? Or they're saying that there's no immediate threat, but hey, anything could happen. What's your reaction to that?
Well, what they're in effect saying is that they're not aware of any imminent threat. And that's a reasonable assumption for a service to make, but you always make it with a certain amount of hope, because you can't be aware necessarily of every lone wolf attack that might happen, and that is the lone wolf attacks are the ones that really are problematic, because you it's almost impossible to see them coming. Yeah. But a bigger attack, a bigger threat is more easily identified, because more people are involved, and once you get more people involved, you can find ways into the plot, or the plots get revealed by one of the participants. It's much more likely that a big attack by a group of people is going to be picked up than a lone wolf attack.
And the Toronto 18 back in the 2010s, we had 18 people to look at.
Exactly.
Yeah, you have more ability to infiltrate those groups of that size.
And the holiday period, Christian and Jewish holidays, are a particular flashpoint.
Absolutely. You're talking large crowds. You're talking Christmas markets. You're talking, again, New Year's Eve last year in Orleans. An ISIS wannabe drove his truck down Bourbon Street. I think he killed 15 people and injured several dozen more. The Germans have had Christmas markets attacked. I just heard something the other day. I don't know if it's true. France may have canceled New Year's celebrations in parts of the country due to the threat scenario. France has always been at a much higher level of threat than we are here in Canada. The Brits have a high threat level as well. The fact is, Libby, if you're a terrorist and you want to take out as many people as possible, what better time than the holidays? You've got people milling about in shopping malls, on streets, in venues, at parties, whatever. It's like, I mean, pardon the analogy, it may sound crass, but it's like shooting fish in a barrel. You've got lots of people who are vulnerable. And as Ward pointed out, you've only got so many security forces, whether they're law enforcement or security intelligence, you can't patrol and you can't monitor everything. And I think people have to understand that. This isn't necessarily a failure on the part of ASIO. And a lot of fingers are being pointed in that direction. I'm rather sensitive to that term. They did what they could at the time. He was not assessed to be a threat. That's why they dropped him. They had other investigations to do. But no one should go under this mythology that there's some kind of perfect system that's going to keep us all safe 100% of the time.
Ward, what would you like to leave people with if people are, certainly Jewish community feeling very nervous, but everyone else? I mean, we have fabulous Christmas markets here. Mm-hmm.
There is always a potential threat. And I'm sure the service and local law enforcement in places where there are big events will have a level of security. Will it turn out to be enough if there's a lone wolf attack? Again, it can be really hard to spot those kinds of attacks. Much easier, as I said, to spot a bigger attack and to identify it in advance and in fact deal with it before it happens. There is a threat out there. I mean, as Phil said earlier, ISIS has not gone away. Its desire to attack the West has not gone away. The reality, in some sense, the only thing that probably protects Canada to some extent. Is that it's always much nicer to have an attack in a country like France or the UK or even on Bondi Beach than in frozen Canada. You may not actually get much coverage in the rest of the world, and they're looking for coverage too.
Absolutely.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up, and we hope for the best. And let us just hope that that the reaction to these terrible attacks, the terrible massacre, will be some kind of turning point for the better. Thanks so much, Phil Gursky and Ward Elcock.
Thanks, Libby. Happy holidays.
Pleasure.
Merry Christmas, Ward.
Merry Christmas to you.
Okay. Merry Christmas to everyone. We are still here. We're taking another break. And when we come back, well, one of the things that the holidays always generate, a lot of things to recycle, and big changes are coming.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, if there is one thing the holidays always generate, it's a lot of stuff that needs to be recycled. And the recycling regime is changing as of January 1st. Now, some people are telling us the only change we will notice is when we have to ask for a new bin or report a problem. Other people are saying, well, the first problem will be those new bins. And here to help us sort through it, we have Matt Kelleher, General Manager of Solid Waste Management at the City of Toronto, and Alan Langdon, who is the CEO of Circular Materials. Hi, both of you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having us.
Okay, let us begin with Matt. So, should we be confident that this is going to be kind of a seamless thing and we're not going to notice any difference?
That is the city's hope, and we've been working very closely with Alan and his team at Circular Materials over the past number of years for the January 1st transition, and I believe that everything will run smoothly between the handover. And the resident will have a seamless experience.
Alan, first of all, give us a little background, please, on what is involved with the handover. What exactly is being handed over to your company?
Yeah, so starting January 1st, Circular Materials will be responsible for operating curbside collection and recycling in the City of Toronto. And like Matt said, our goal is to ensure that it's a seamless transition. And for the most part, residents won't really experience any changes either to the collection container or to their collection schedule.
Okay. And what about the actual physical recycling of it? Are there any changes in the back, you know, when the stuff gets where it's going?
For the most part, the material is going to the same place it's been going for the last 3 years since we first took over in 2023. The city has been working with us as a collector since 2023. And that material has all been going to a sorting facility in North York. It's run by GFL. I think if there is, you know, any change to really be aware of is that starting on January 1st, there'll be additional materials that can be included in the blue box.
Ooh, I can hardly wait to hear about that. I always find it all very confusing. Matt, I was in touch with Councillor Paula Fletcher. And she cited the issue of the replacement bins. She says that it might be problematic that if people need their bins replaced, they will only be able to get a gigantic bin.
So, the replacement bins are under the purview of Circular Materials. So the city right now, we supply a number of different sizes based on the needs of the resident. But in terms of that moving forward under provincial regulation, I'd have to let Alan speak to what bin sizes that Circular Material would be rolling out specifically for Toronto.
Okay, Alan.
Yeah, so I think the process is going to be much as it was before. So it's the same provider that's helping us with replacement bins. So I don't expect a significant change. Our default will be the large 360-liter bin. But if folks are finding that too big, they will be able to request a smaller bin, 240 liter. And so there will be those two sizes available.
And
just to, if I can add to that, what Alan and Circular Materials and the city have been doing over the past number of years in order to make the transition as smooth as possible is we have sold the existing bin stock to Circular Materials. So if a resident right now has a medium bin, they can continue to use that medium bin if they have a large bin or an extra large bin. So back to where the two organizations are really working very closely on the seamless transition, that bin that you are currently using will be the bin that you can use January 1st. And when it gets replaced, that's when the protocol would move over to Circular Materials, and those other bin options would then be available on the replacement side.
Okay, let's talk about what new things we can put in the bin. One of the things that I always notice, because I'm surprised that manufacturers haven't sort of backed off, is my understanding is you can't put anything black there because the machines won't recognize it. And especially around holiday time, a lot of the packaging seems to be black. So is that still the case, Ellen?
Nope. Starting January 1st, black plastics will be included as part of a unified province-wide material list. So as of January 1st, whether you're in Toronto, Parry Sound, Kenora, everyone will have access to the same unified material list for collection. It'll include black plastics. It'll include deodorant and toothpaste tubes, ice cream tubs, and frozen juice containers. And if people are looking for a website to look at all the complete list of materials collected, they can go to our website at circularmaterials.ca/recycleontario.
Okay. The next question is, so those things that are being added, how clean do they have to be? I mean, I don't know how you get every last bit of toothpaste out of a toothpaste tube, even with some of the clamshells that had takeout in them. They're not great to go in a dishwasher. They can be hard to clean.
Yeah, I think we expect people to give things a good rinse. It doesn't have to be perfect. You know, if there's a little piece of lettuce left in a small piece of lettuce left in a clamshell, it's not going to be the end of the world. But the cleaner the material is going into the blue box, the better opportunities we have of maximizing the yield of recovered material once it gets through the sorting facilities and ultimately at the recyclers. So we do ask that people take, you know, efforts. You know, one of the things I see often is and we see from time to time, is a jar of peanut butter that's one third still full of peanut butter. That is not going to be accepted. We won't be able to recycle that. But if we're talking, as long as people have given it a good rinse and it's relatively clean, shouldn't be a problem.
Let me give you other examples with, say, cosmetics, right? So if you're using a lotion of some kind, you can't get all of it out. Even you want to use it, you've paid for it. And so if you get a plastic bottle of body lotion, but it's got some body lotion in it, like, what do you do?
Yeah, again, you just try and get as much out as possible. And, you know, that is one of the new materials. And, you know, we're accepting that because, you know, the producers, the manufacturers of that, so companies that make these types of products, have taken a lot of efforts over the last few years to change the makeup of their tubes so that it's a single type of plastic as opposed to previous versions where, you know, it was a mix of different plastics. So, you know, other than the residue, it's a highly recyclable package. And so we want to include it. We want people to take every effort to get as much of that material out. But, you know, that's something we're prepared for and we'll manage with our recycling partners to make sure that we can still recycle that material. The least amount of material left is the best, but we understand you're not going to be able to get all of it out.
Okay. And the other thing is, one of the things we've always been told that if you kind of make one mistake in your bin, it's all going to a landfill. Is that true?
No, I think we've got a lot of work over the days, weeks, months ahead to educate people on what can and can't go in the recycling bin. But I do want to be clear, like Toronto has one of the highest contamination rates in Canada, well north of 30%.
Wow.
And so when we have a contamination rate that high, it really inhibits our ability to recycle the material because it's really kind of a garbage in, garbage out type of system. So if we can reduce the contamination on the material coming into the system, we'll have a much better chance of recycling material on the outbound. But really, in our initial, you know, months and year in operation, we're really focused on consumer education, telling people what can be recycled, and having discussions like this about the steps you need to take to prepare your material for recycling, like using as much material in the tube as possible, cleaning the container as much as reasonably possible.
Okay, we're out of time. Who wants to give the website out again where people can go to get educated?
Yeah. If people are looking for more information, we have a webpage dedicated just to Toronto. So circularmaterials.ca/Toronto. There's all the information you need about the changes coming up, as well as how the system will operate going forward.
And Matt, anything you want to leave us with?
Just that if your materials are, if it's related to garbage or organics, please continue to call 311. And just in terms of a transition, we are working, again, very closely with Circular Materials in our effort under this new provincial regulation to have a seamless transition. So,
okay, that was a question. So the green bin stays the same.
Absolutely.
All righty. That was very informative, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much to both of you, and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye. That is all the time we have for today. I'm taking a couple of days off. You will have Jane and then Tasha, and I will be back on Friday with another edition of our Alternative Free for All Fridays. And that's all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.